The Dowager Empress Qi Qi was a larger-than-life woman who ruled China for much of the second half of the 19th century. Since her death in 1908, she's been largely disparaged as a leader and characterized as a villainous dragon lady. Well, after examining newly available Chinese historical documents, Zheng Chang has come up with a very different portrait of Qi Qi, that of a thoughtful and courageous ruler who launched many reforms, including changes in the country's educational, financial, and legal systems, and spurred China's transformation from a medieval to a modern state. Zheng Chang is the author of two previous books. Her first, Wild Swans, has been translated into 40 languages and sold 15 million copies. Her latest, called simply Dowager Empress Qi Qi, is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Zheng Chang to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Several critics have characterized this book as a revisionist portrait of the Dowager Empress, and sometimes the term revisionist is used in kind of a pejorative sense. What was it your intention to write a revisionist history?
Yes, I think it was, although, of course, her full picture only came out when I got to the end of the book or my research. You know, I got interested in her when I was researching Wild Swans 20 years ago. I realized that she was the person who banned foot binding. Because I grew up in communist China. For some reason, I thought the communists banned foot binding. And then I was surprised to realize that it was this Empress Dowager, and which is different from the, you know, the propaganda. Then when I was researching my biography of Mao Zedong, I was astonished by the kind of freedom and opportunities the young Mao who lived under Empress Dowager Cixi enjoyed. And he was a peasant lad, yet he could get scholarships, to go to college, to go abroad, to write for very free press, and to travel with girlfriends and check into hotels. All the sexual and the intellectual freedoms I couldn't dream of having when I was growing up under Mao. So I knew, you know, a little bit different from her reputation.
Was she treated harshly in both nationalist and communist literature?
I'm afraid yes.
So Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek, they all made her into the Dragon Lady, and then Mao just continued that?
I think more or less, yes. I think that the Republicans, after she died, the Republicans wanted to portray her as this diehard conservative, cruel despot who dragged China behind, who left China in a mess, and it fell on them to rescue China. The nationalists said Sun Yat-sen is the founding father of modern China, and the communists say Mao is.
And you're saying it's the Empress Dowager.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Both of your earlier books are banned in China, and your visits to the country are restricted, aren't they? You're only allowed to go there to visit your elderly mother. So what happens? Can you do research there?
When I started researching the Empress Dowager, it was 2008, and that was relatively liberal area because that was the year of the Olympics. So I was allowed to talk to the Qing, that's her dynasty, scholars, to look at the archives even, and of course to see my mother, who's elderly, frail. And of course, most of the research you can even do outside China.
Because everything's available online now?
A lot of things, all the imperial decrees were digitalized. And of course, a lot of scholars and archivists have been working away since Mao died in the late 1970s. There was a wealth of documentary stuff for me to work on.
Do you think that this book is likely to be banned in China as well?
Well, I keep my fingers crossed that it won't, because, you know, Cixi died in 1908. She's a historical figure. She shouldn't be politically sensitive. But her last years in the first decade of the 20th century do have some similarities with today's China. In both cases, the country have been through open-door policies, decades of economic development, rising political expectations. And where do we go? They face the same problem.
But there was a big difference. There's a lot more power from the foreign governments than there is today.
Well, the thing is, there's still the Chinese government to make decisions in her time as well as in today's time. In her time, she decided to push on for political reforms. Her last project was to create a constitutional monarchy with an elected parliament. She was going to give the Chinese the vote.
You say that although she was no saint, she was a lot shrewder and more perceptive and forward-looking a politician than she's been given credit for. Do you think to some degree it's because she grew up relatively uneducated?
Well,
she was a concubine, wasn't she, originally?
Yes, she was a concubine, but that doesn't mean she was no saint. And she was no saint because her roots were in medieval China. She was born in 1835 when China had, you know, punishments like death by a thousand cuts. I mean, she abolished that, by the way. And China was a medieval society, and she was the absolute ruler of a third of the world's population. I mean, she was capable of immense ruthlessness. But by comparison, you know, to her predecessors, the previous empress, and her successors, particularly Mao, you know, who was responsible for the death of over 70 million Chinese in peacetime, her rule was incredibly benign.
My guest is Yung Chang. Her latest book, Empress Dowager Cixi, the concubine who launched modern China. She joined the court as a concubine when she was 16 years old. So, and this was the name that was given to her, Cixi?
No, she got that name later. When she joined the court, we don't know what her name was because women in those days were regarded as too low to have their names recorded. She was just paraded in front of the emperor with hundreds of other girls, and she caught the eye of the emperor, and she was made a low rank concubine.
Well, she, judging from the photograph on the cover, she was not the most beautiful woman in China. So why do you think she got the attention of the emperor? Was it simply because she gave birth to the first woman in his harem to give birth to a son?
That's how her position rose in the harem. But she first caught the eye of the emperor because she had expressive eyes. I mean, her officials mentioned later. I mean, she knew how to, you know. I mean, so she became a concubine, and then she produced the only son of the emperor. And when the emperor died, in fact, as a result of the British invasion of China in 1860.
As part of the Opium Wars, was that?
What people call that the Second Opium War. It was really the British wanted China to open its doors, and the Chinese emperor didn't want to, so the British invaded and burned down the old summer palace. Mm-hmm. And the emperor fled the court, fled Beijing with Cixi and the court, and ended up in the northern wilderness. He was so heartbroken. He didn't want to return to Beijing, and he died in self-imposed exile. They had only one son, and the son was 5 years old. So the emperor named 8 grandees to be the regents for the son. But Cixi, aged 25, launched a coup and ousted these agents and made herself the real ruler of China.
On the other hand, her story reads a bit like a tragic opera. At the end of her life, when she'd become ill, suspected that her death was imminent, she poisoned her adopted son, Wang Zhu, so that, you explain, he wouldn't outlive her and pass control of China to the Japanese. That seems horrible, but we also keep in mind that he had been part of a plot to kill her earlier.
That's right. And also, we must also remember, 20 years later, the Japanese got the last emperor, Puyi, their puppet, made Puyi their puppet emperor. But that, before, you know, during the Second World War. But Puyi was only the puppet emperor for Manchukuo, for northeast of China. And if the Japanese had had their way with Emperor Guangxu, they would have had the whole of China. And China would have lost its independence, and the world would have faced this nightmare, if I may say, of a giant East Asian empire led by aggressive and the increasingly fascist Japan. The Japanese had already got a hold on the emperor. I mean, there's a lot of details in the book.
He became their puppet, in effect.
Yes, but of course, Tsushi put him under house arrest. But if she died and he was still alive, he would be free to be the emperor and the puppet emperor.
So why has she been blamed for the fall of the Qing dynasty in 1911? To what extent was she responsible?
Well, in a way, she was responsible because, you know, she buried her own dynasty. And when she launched all the reforms, you know, free press, sending people abroad, and people then started to spout this anti-Manchu sentiment because the Manchu rule, the Qing dynasty rule, is a minority rule. The Manchus were only 1% of the Chinese population. And of course, when the people got education and they said, why are we accepting these Manchu rules? Done with the Manchus, we want to be a republic. And so it was almost inevitable. She tried to rescue her dynasty and build a kind of, you know, constitutional monarchy. But on her deathbed, she knew this was a project that was most likely to fail. She accepted China becoming a republic. And people say that shows she was weak. She failed.
But also, she's a woman, and so people are going to look for weakness, aren't they?
Yes.
Or if she's strong, they're going to see her as manipulative and a dragon lady.
That's right. I mean, you know, she can't win. But I think, you know, by making that decision and accepting China being a republic and burying her own dynasty, she showed greatness because she wanted to avoid bloodshed and civil war by burying her own dynasty.
Wasn't one of the Manchu rules that men had to wear pigtails? That was a source of great resentment, wasn't it?
It was indeed.
It was a way of saying we, the Manchus, even though because we conquered China, we can make you do things that humiliate you?
Well, I think to make men wear pigtails itself was not a humiliation. It was rather a badge of submission. Because the Manchus wore pigtails, and when they conquered China in the 17th century, they ordered all Han Chinese, you know, sort of over 90% of the population, to wear their hairstyle to show that they submit to their rule. It was indeed a source of resentment.
In a positive review of your book in the October 25th issue of the New York Times, Orville Schell wrote that the Chinese Communist Party today faces challenges, mainly the need for internal reforms that are similar to those that were faced 100 years ago by the Empress Dowager Cixi and the Qing court. Do you see those parallels?
Yes, I think there are a lot of parallels. In fact, I think she is soon, or if not already, becoming politically sensitive. You're not allowed to talk about her now because her answer is exactly different from today's regime. She pushed forward for political reforms, whereas today's leaders, or some of them at least, seem to be calling to wind the clock back and to readopt Mao's method. And when the Empress Dowager was alive, and people suggested that what she should do. She should stop sending people abroad, stop giving them modern education, stop allowing a free press. But she rejected that. She didn't want to wind the clock back, and she went forward, and she is different.
Well, people have been predicting for a long time now that as China becomes more and more open to the world, it's going to democratize, and it seems to have resisted that. And once again, just recently, we've seen the government clamping down on things. Well, if Xi Ji is any model, by democratizing, she actually brought everything down. Maybe the current rulers see her as a warning for democratization.
Well, indeed, I think some of them might think that way. History, we can't stretch history to make an exact comparison. I mean, my book, in any case, is not a political fable. I mean, if they look at Cixi's rule, I mean, they might learn sort of lessons of how to avoid certain problems, mistakes she committed, how to avoid certain pitfalls. And they probably learned, as a leader, they should put the interest of the people in front of the interest of a small group.
China had a couple of women who were empresses, and in both cases they had troubled times in power because they were women?
Oh, yes. I mean, the only woman who declared herself the emperor was Wu Zetian, long time ago. And Cixi admired her. But she never wanted to declare herself the emperor, even though her son was hopeless and her adopted son, both emperors, was pathetic. I mean,
so she became the Empress Dowager instead.
Yes, she preferred to rule from behind the throne, if possible.
Ying Chang will be speaking with Orville Schell tomorrow at 6:30 at Park Avenue and 70th Street. Her book is Empress Dowager Xi Ji, The Concubine Who Launched Modern China, and it is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.